A little over a year ago, a series of articles in the Washington Post exposed deplorable conditions at Walter Reed, the Army's top medical facility. It serves the wounded from Iraq and Afghanistan. Ann Hull and Dana Priest reported that story and spoke to us shortly afterwards.
Building 18 is a former motor lodge across the street from Walter Reed. It's actually outside the post, and it's a fairly dank old motel, and since the war in Iraq started, it has been used to house wounded soldiers. And it is, many rooms had mold. There are mice. There was a mice infestation in the building, roaches. One room, you know, you could go into the bathroom and see the next guy's tub above you. The floor was rotted out. And it was not a good place to live for anyone, let alone wounded soldiers. And there are many psychiatric patients living in that building who have PTSD, post-traumatic stress. And to live in that sort of environment and outside the protective gates of Walter Reed was very stressful. And it actually hindered the recovery of a lot of the people we talked to inside that building.
Ann Hull on Talk of the Nation a year ago. Yesterday afternoon, the Washington Post won 6 Pulitzer Prizes. The prestigious prize for public service went to that series on Walter Reed. Dana Priest, an investigative reporter for the Washington Post, and Ann Hull, an Enterprise reporter on the newspaper's national desk, join us here at the museum. Congratulations. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
If you or a relative was treated at Walter Reed Army Medical Center or in the military medical system, we'd love to hear from you. Did this newspaper series change things? 1-800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join our conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Ann Hull, why don't we begin with Building 18? What's there today? Has it changed?
Building 18 is no longer being used to house the wounded. It's been shuttered since probably a week or 10 days after our stories ran.
Well, congratulations again. What's it being used for now, do you think?
We don't know. We often drive by and see lights on, but they're only in the lobby and not in the rooms.
Mm-hmm. Have you been following up on this story, Dana?
Well, we have. In fact, over the last year, we've written a dozen stories about soldier care of one form or another. One of the things that we realized doing the Walter Reed stories was the very desperate straits of mental health issues, particularly post-traumatic stress disorders. So we did a separate series just on that and looked at how that affects individuals, one in particular we wanted to profile. But then we also took a look at the system and found many problems, stigma at the Army level, leadership level, but also just poor care, not really realizing how to treat this, even though it had been something that combat veterans have dealt with since there was combat.
A lot of the explanation you heard, to be honest and be fair to those in charge, a lot of people said, this is deplorable, we have to fix it. But a lot of the explanation we heard was, in fact, that we did not anticipate the length and the intensity of the wars in Iraq, especially Iraq and Afghanistan. We did not anticipate this level of casualties. We did not anticipate that there was going to be such a need. We did not anticipate so many people who would be injured as opposed to killed and would survive these kinds of injuries. After looking at all of this, do you think that's a valid explanation? Anne?
Well, the casualty flow was continuous. There was never a break, so it wasn't a surprise that this war was non-ending. 3 times a week, medevac flights landed at Walter Reed, and it was a steady flow. So they just did not staff up, prepare, or gear up for the psychological and physical wounds that were coming in.
Hmm.
I would also, it's a poor excuse for several reasons. If the Army couldn't handle it, they could have given it to somebody who could, but they wouldn't do that because culturally that would be against a lot of their own beliefs that they can handle anything. That's still an issue. They still have trouble getting psychologists and psychiatrists, in part because they will not go outside and they won't accept the volunteers and other people that are willing to help them. So they still have some of their own barriers. They can get as much money as they want from Congress. They've gotten an awful lot, hundreds of millions of dollars since the story ran, and yet it is still a problem. They still cannot get services to everybody who needs it.
We're talking with Ann Hull and Dana Priest of the Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize winners for their series that started about a year ago on deplorable medical conditions at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And let me ask you also, Dana Priest, your story came out, I guess, shortly after the transfer of the switch from Mr. Rumsfeld at the Defense Department and on to the current Secretary of Defense. How much a difference do you think that made?
In terms of doing the story, it didn't make any difference, because once we discovered that this was actually a problem, we didn't seek the Army's help in any way reporting it. In fact, we did the opposite. We went under the radar and were up on Walter Reed many times in 4 months that we were there. So they didn't help in any way. What was different, I think, was the reaction, and that is that Secretary Gates did not deny any of the problems, and he didn't disparage the media, and he didn't try to, you know, intimidate us from not doing anything else. He embraced the problem and then ordered people to try to fix it. And that's not a pattern that Secretary Rumsfeld had, but who knows?
Mm-hmm. The Pulitzer Board cited your work for, in their words, evoking a national outcry and producing reforms by federal officials. As an investigative reporter, do you think they got that last part right?
Lots of good has come from these stories. Legislation was, you know, sped up, good changes in the structure of how the Army deals with wounded. But we heard yesterday from a lot of the folks that we wrote about, and they wanted to send good wishes, but you could hear the fatigue in their voices. Many are still dealing with the problems they dealt with at Walter Reed. They've only, you know, switched their lives to the VA. Dell and Annette McLeod, for instance, whom we wrote about, Dell was injured by a steel cargo door that hit him in the head. He and his wife spend 400 miles a week in the car going to VA appointments, going to med board appointments. So in some ways, the problem continues for a lot of the families we wrote about.
Let's see if we can get some callers in on the conversation. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. And let's go to Brian. Brian is with us from Worcester in Massachusetts.
Thanks, Neil. How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Well, I'm just calling. I wasn't actually at Walter Reed myself. I was stationed in Bahrain at the Navy base there, and I came down and they thought my appendix needed to be taken out. So the doctors said that they couldn't take care of me at the medical center there. They sent me by ambulance out into the city in Bahrain and at the Defense Hospital there by ambulance, and they left me there. I was supposed to be, you know, talking with doctors, but getting my appendix taken out. I was given morphine, speaking with doctors that spoke little English. And after they decided to not, you know, take my appendix out, I was basically left out on the curb in 110 degree heat and waiting for somebody to come pick me up. But as far as in the States, you know, my medical treatment in the States has been, you know, very high, and it has been unsurpassed by many things, but it's just a lot different overseas when we get treated.
Nevertheless, Brian, I was happy to be looking at Dana Priest as you were telling your story about getting outsourced to the hospital there in Bahrain. And is that common practice as far as you know?
For many of the cases of my friends and colleagues that I know, it is, because some of the medical facilities overseas in, like, Bahrain, they can't do anything as far as surgery over there. So it's all outsourced to Bahraini hospitals. In this case, it was the Defense Hospital in Bahrain.
Mm-hmm. Dana, is this something you're aware of?
I think that in places where we have agreements and good relations with the host countries, that it's not unusual, but only if the American system can't handle it.
Okay. Brian, thanks very much for the call.
And Thank you.
Hold the your medical problems are all worked out?
Not quite yet. We're still working them out.
All right. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you. Bye.
Let's go to a call to a question here in the audience at the museum.
Hi, my name is Karelia Pajan. I'm a journalism student from George Washington University, and I was wondering, how do you think the unusual way you wrote this story is more of a narrative than a hard news story influenced the way it was received, and if you think this is more effective for breaking news stories?
Well, we decided to kind of meld narrative and investigative journalism, and it was an effective way to do this. It required lots of on-the-ground reporting. We spent you know, nights and days at Walter Reed, watching the small details of someone's life. It's one thing in an investigative piece to say the patient takes 24 pills at night. It's another thing to watch that soldier and sleep in their rooms and watch his wife dole out 24 pills and catch the dialogue between them. So it brought to life the problems. As instead of, you know, reciting the problems, we wanted to illuminate and give really organic evidence to what was going on.
When the reactions started coming in, one of the things we both remarked on was people would call up and they would say over and over again, it made me cry, and then I got mad. And that's why I think the reaction reverberated beyond their homes where they were reading this story, and they just flooded the Defense Department and their local congressman member with phone calls and emails that just couldn't be ignored. And so it was a combination that worked well in this case.
Go ahead, Ann.
You know, I think journalists show their patriotism in odd ways, and we always saw our job as how do we translate this heartbreak and outrage that we were feeling and we were witnessing into something that could make life better for those soldiers, and that's what we tried to do.
Thanks very much for the question. We're talking with Pulitzer Prize winners Dana Priest and Ann Hull of The Washington Post. We're doing a special broadcast today from the museum, a special new, beautiful museum of journalism in Washington, D.C., and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line, and let's go to Layton. Layton with us from Charleston.
Yes, thank you. I was a member of a 14-person task force put together by the Department of Defense, which was working last year when the Walter Reed story erupted. And the Surgeon General of the Army was one of the members of our task force, as a matter of fact. I'm a civilian psychiatrist. And I think it's naive to think that the Department of Defense, even with money, of which there still is not enough, even with money, can solve the medical manpower problem so quickly. You just can't do that. You can't find people to contract with to bring them in. Unfortunately, the military medicine was, at least in the mental health services, was marginally staffed to begin with, and then the war came. And I just think it's a bigger problem. It's not an easily fixed problem.
Dana Priest, is he right?
Well, it's not an easy to fix problem, and the way they've gone about it is not radical solutions, which, you know, it depends on how fast you want to fix this. We still are in a market economy where you double the salary of psychiatrists and psychologists living elsewhere, I bet you they'd come to Walter Reed. You couldn't get people to come here for the type of pay they were being offered in a very expensive area, even if you boosted the housing allowance. What they didn't do then is to say, let's just go and break the rules and go much further beyond that. And they still have that problem. They aren't quite thinking outside the boxes, as everybody likes to say on this issue. And they aren't developing enough new psychologists that are going to come online to help them. But they are standing up dozens of task forces of officers to assess the problem, and that is something that really needs to be watched, because there are a lot of people involved in that rather than involved in providing health care.
Okay, let's get thanks very much for the call, Layton. Appreciate it. Let's go to a question here at the museum.
Hi, I'm Johnny Goldstein. I blog at johnnygoldstein.com, and I was struck by your statement that there's a lot of shame in the military about their wounded,
I think they were talking about mental health and the stigma.
Okay. So did you get any sense of what the roots of that are?
Well, it's a macho environment, a macho culture, and unless officers are seen going into the combat stress trailer for help, the enlisted and lower ranked are not going to go for help. It's something that the Army says it needs to fix, but is very slow to kind of have a culture shift in the way it looks at mental illness. But we're seeing more and more statistics that show those who go back two times, three times, four times, which is becoming more common, are suffering. One in four have symptoms of post-traumatic stress. So they're going to be forced to deal with this, I think, more than they have.
And they go at this in insidious ways, really. I mean, on the one hand, they've said, we are embracing this. You won't be penalized. On the other hand, they're calling their new mental health initiative resilience. You know,
bounce back.
As if you were only more resilient. And I'm sure they're not doing it to make the situation worse. It just, to me, is a symbol of how much they still need to understand that this is as real. Mental illness is as real as, you know, not having a limb.
One cannot help but notice you're talking about the amount of time you both spent on this story, and not just last year, but over the past year. And that as the Pulitzers were announced yesterday, there was no end of comment about an industry which is losing readership, losing advertising, and cutting back on a lot of jobs. As that trend goes ahead, do you fear that the kind of time that you two were able to invest in this story is going to become an even more precious commodity?
Well, it could, because the easy thing to do is to just be a derivative outlet of news, to take, you know, the CNN news of today and talk about it. But at the Post, for sure, and other big papers that have enough staff and cushion right now, I think they realize that the only thing that they have going for them is to deliver news you can't get anywhere else. And that is really smart political news, but also in investigative reporting that you can't find elsewhere. So and they're talking as if that's part of their new business model, that they need to devote more to that sort of enterprise.
Thank you both, and again, congratulations. Now, what do you do after you win the Pulitzer Prize? You get a date at the museum? Is that part of it? Our broadcast today was produced by David Gura. Drew Reynolds is our technical director. He got help today from Michael Cullen, Kevin Waite, and John Widoff. The program would not happen without them. We'd also like to thank the entire team here at the museum for their hospitality, Jack Hurley and Susan Bennett, deputy directors at the new museum. Also, Jim Updike, Dennis Dunbar, and Walt Hassett on the technical side. Thanks to them all. Next Wednesday, we'll be back at the museum. Barry Goldwater Jr. and John Dean will join us to talk about the private journal of Senator Barry Goldwater, including his candid thoughts on Richard Nixon. Join us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan at the museum in Washington, D.C.